Aloha. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It's Monday, August 25th. I'm Bill Dorman, in for Catherine Cruz. President Trump met with South Korea's leader for the first time today in a lively Oval Office session. We'll get some regional insights from the East-West Center's presidential chair, Gene Lee, along with thoughts on what it all means for Hawaii. A new approach to long-term recovery on Maui. Dozens of volunteers will be arriving in coming months to rebuild homes. We'll get the latest. We take a closer look at the tradition of chewing betel nut. It's on the rise in Hawaii. We hear why health experts are concerned about the long-term effects. Plus, we hear from the creators of HPR's new podcast, Feathers and Fire. It's tied to the Apple TV Plus series, Chief of War. We'll talk about history, storytelling, and the impact of the series in Hawaii. Aloha, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, in for Catherine Cruz. World leaders seem to have learned that meetings in the Oval Office can be a bit unpredictable. That was certainly the case today for South Korea's president. He's only been in office since early June. In December, his predecessor declared martial law and was later removed from office. But important talks are underway involving trade and security, and Hawaii is very much part of that picture. Here to help us through that is Jean Lee. She's the presidential chair at the East-West Center, a longtime policy analyst of the Korean Peninsula and a former journalist with extensive reporting experience in North Korea from 2008 to 2017, including opening the AP Bureau in Pyongyang in 2012. She's also testified before Congress about North Korea. Thanks for coming in this morning, Jean. And to start with, what struck you about the meeting today, at least the part that was on live TV all around the world?
Yeah, and it's great to join you. I'm glad I got back from Seoul in time to join you in the studio for this discussion and to watch that press conference. You know, there was a lot I was watching for because this is the South Korean president's first meeting with President Trump. It's his first trip to the United States. And really, it's our first chance to see him in this type of international setting. Now, he is a seasoned politician. He has a long history of politics in South Korea, but I haven't seen him in an international context. So I was watching to see how he would handle himself with President Trump, who is, as you say, unpredictable. But, you know, I was impressed. He clearly has a good circle of advisors who have a lot of experience dealing with President Trump and probably prepared him for that unpredictability. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think he handled himself well. He was clearly given notes on how to flatter the president.
Right.
And so I think he hit all the right notes, I think. May have been awkward at first, which is not surprising. But I think he handled himself well. And that was an important thing for him to project to his people in South Korea, because I think that there's a lot of concern about how he would handle himself with President Trump. So we'll see. We'll see what comes out of the discussions and what they discuss behind closed doors and what they reveal about what they discuss behind closed doors.
Exactly. You know, you mentioned that you just came back from Seoul. What is the mood there, the sense in terms of political division, popularity of the president, but also this idea of division?
Yeah, you know, the South Korean president came into office in such unusual circumstances. The country was going through really extreme political paralysis. I think South Koreans were really shocked by the former president's attempt to impose martial law. It was a moment for them to really put their young democracy to the test. And I think they really stuck to their guns in terms of fighting for democracy. This president, who's in office now, had very little time. After the president was impeached and taken out of office, they had a short campaign period. He was elected in early June, and then, bam, no transition, had to hit the ground running, had to lead the country through this period of intense political division, and I think really had to move very quickly on national security, on the economy, on foreign policy, to get Korea back on track. They missed a crucial period. President Trump took office for a second term in January when they were in the throes of political paralysis, and they were distracted for months. Mm. That was a time when they really needed to get to D.C., start negotiations. They knew this tariff policy was coming, and so they missed some months. He had to do that dual task of trying to heal the division while show that he could lead the country out of this crisis and take the lead on the economy, on national security, on foreign policy. So I would say, you know, the division, the political divisions are still there. It's still very divided. That is an ongoing process because we're seeing right now the former president's wife being indicted and prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So that is still very, very tense. But I think that this summit, long time coming, is a moment for them to recognize that to see that they're moving forward as a country. They're back out there on the international stage, back in the good graces of Washington, D.C., in the middle of investment, in the middle of policymaking. So I think that will be reassuring for the South Koreans.
A key part of that also, and again, the perspective from Hawaii within the region, is Japan. And President Lee made a big point of stopping in Japan before the United States. The two leaders had a joint declaration the first time in 17 years. There was such a document, they said, after that meeting. How important is that, and why is that trilateral relationship? Certainly came up in the photo op, but that's a key part of these meetings as well.
Yeah, this is really significant. One of the concerns that I had, and I think that some South Koreans and Korea watchers have had, is that this party, his party, the Democratic Party, they sometimes prioritize nationalism over internationalism, multilateralism. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so I was curious to see whether Lee Jae-myung would do, President Lee would do that as well. I'm pleasantly surprised to see that he has made outreach to Japan a priority. And it's significant to have had his first meeting with a leader to be with the leader of Japan, even before he went to meet with the president of the United States, sends a strong message about what he calls shuttle diplomacy and the desire to repair that relationship and bring it into the foreign policy that he would like to focus on. So I thought that was really important. Now, when we talk about North Korea, we will get to why that's important as well. But finding a way to get past these historical grievances, they have a very difficult relationship that not only goes back to the colonialization of Korea by Japan from 1910 to 1935, extremely painful period that has been very hard for these two neighbors to get past, but it goes back hundreds of years. So it's a long relationship of neighbors where South Korea has felt put upon, stepped upon, invaded, colonized. It's been very hard to get past. These steps by the South Korean, both South Korea and Japan, are really important because they need to work together. I will say that I think that when you have a U.S. president who says he wants to make America great again, in some ways maybe it pushes the neighbors in the region together because they're thinking we might need to work together to try to figure out how to deal with this new this U.S. president. So
That context, again, in the context of history that you mentioned, the issue of comfort women, which Trump immediately went to in the Oval Office talking about this trilateral relationship. But he mentioned also, President Lee mentioned his stop in Tokyo as part of that.
So when I visited Japan and met with Prime Minister Ishiba, I realized that many of the obstacles that existed between our two countries have now been removed.
Sure. During my term. We removed them during my term. There was an overlay a little bit, but we removed many of those obstacles during my term. And, you know, if you look at Prime Minister Abe, who was a great man, he was a great friend of mine, and he was assassinated, but he felt very warmly toward your country, I can tell you that. And the current prime minister, who I've gotten to know very well, feels the same way. So I think you're going to have a great relationship with Japan.
Again, looking forward to relations. We're going to take a break just for a minute here. We're going to be back with Gene Lee of the East-West Center and more on the U.S., South Korea, and a bit on Hawaii when we come back.
Support for HPR comes from the Academy for Healthcare Innovation, offering a hands-on program that teaches the skills needed to be certified in a healthcare role. Learn more at ahihawaii.org.
This Saturday, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents the Honolulu Brass Quintet. Enjoy live classical music performances with HPR every Saturday in August. Learn more at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects and planners for the Honoʻuluʻuli Middle School in East Kapolei, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation. Bill Dorman with you, in for Catherine Cruz today. We've been talking with Gene Lee, presidential chair at the East-West Center, one of the few journalists to consistently report from North Korea. A couple of notes briefly. The East-West Center is an underwriter of HPR. Also, I took part in a senior journalist program with the East-West Center in South Korea. But
great.
Yes. Excellent experience, by the way. But the point of North Korea within, and President Lee brought this in earlier, he joked about, build a skyscraper Trump Tower in Pyongyang and play golf with the president. President Trump, of course, talked about his great relationship with Kim Jong-un. How does this play in Pyongyang, in the region, and what's important about this?
So we should remember that President Trump did carry out this very bold diplomacy in 2018 and 2019 in reaching out to Kim Jong-un. And yeah, you know, a lot of people will look at it like a failure because they did not come up with a deal in 2018 or 2019. But one thing that they did build was a rapport. It's clear that they built a friendship. And I think that it's quite possible that President Trump told Kim Jong-un in Hanoi in February of 2019, it's not the right time, but maybe we can get back to it later. And in the meantime, what Kim Jong-un did, a massive disappointment. I mean, I'm thinking Kim Jong-un, he took this train out to Hanoi,
right?
Yes. And I don't think he was planning that train ride back. 66 hours must have been so painful for everyone around him. But you know, he was very disappointed. But I'm sure what he was thinking was, it wasn't enough. My weapons program wasn't enough. Let me use the time to get that program where it needs to be. And we've certainly seen him do that over the past however many years it's been. I can't add. 6 years?
Yes.
What is it, 6 years? You know, this is what I've been focusing on. I chase the money trail when it comes to how North Korea finances its weapons program. And that's what I talk about in my podcast for the BBC, which is The Lazarus Heist. We are focusing right now. You know, I do talk about the diplomacy, the context. And right now we're focusing on the relationship between North Korea and Russia and how that helps him advance his, Kim Jong-un advance his weapons program, but also how the cyber theft funds it. But this is all to say that I do believe that at some point Kim Jong-un wants to get back to the negotiating table. It's very hard to see right now, but if certain things play out the way that I think they might, we could see a negotiation like that happening. However, for the time being, for Kim Jong-un has been snubbing the South Korean president. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that was important at this summit between President Lee and President Trump was for President Lee to show Kim Jong-un that he has the ear of President Trump, that they have a rapport, and also perhaps to ask President Trump to play a role in the engagement. So we are seeing a shift in policy in South Korea that is extreme. The previous president was very hardline against North Korea and believed in isolation. We now have the former opposition leader in power, Lee Jae-myung, President Lee, who is very engagement-focused. And so there's, with the shift of leaders, there's an opportunity for engagement with North Korea. He did say in his press conference, he did ask President Trump to be a peacemaker.
Yes.
And he said, then I will be a pacemaker. Now, I don't think he meant a pacemaker in someone's heart, but he wants to signal to Kim Jong-un, I have a role in this. I have the ear of the U.S. president. So that was a significant thing as well. That was something I was watching for. I was watching for also is, will President Trump and President Lee stand together on deterrence? Or will they go straight to engagement? It seems to me that they went straight to the engagement aspect. Mm-hmm. But deterrence is obviously a part of it. The U.S.-South Korea military alliance that goes back to the Korean War is about deterrence. We have 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea to protect South Korea from North Korean aggression. And that is also going to be part of the discussion between these two countries, is what happens with those troops, who pays for it,
right?
What does that look like?
And there has been talk in terms of China of what happens if Taiwan has issues that requires redeployment of forces from South Korea. I know that's part of the world that Indo-PACOM here in Hawaii looks at very, very closely. But those interrelationships are very important.
Yes. So we call that strategic flexibility, this idea that you can use troops for different purposes. Do we want the U.S. troops who are based in South Korea to be solely focused on North Korea, or do we want them to have some flexibility so that they can be available to jump in if something happens with China?
Now, and clearly that's the view of the Trump administration, perhaps less so in terms of from South Korea. Let me ask you another question while we have time, though. Indo-PACOM is not the only tie of Hawaii to South Korea as well. Not historically, first immigration to the United States coming through Hawaii, but also deep ties.
So, you know, Hawaii has such a special place in the story of Korean immigration to the United States. This was one of the first ports that they came to in 1903, is the year that we mark as the start of Korean immigration to the United States. Plantation workers and picture brides. I think that that history is so moving. One of my friends, Jin Young Lee, has a film called Songs of Love from Hawaii that really captures those stories. But, you know, I have to say that over the 120 plus years since Koreans have been coming to Hawaii, South Korea has risen so dramatically, has gone through so much, and has become, has gone from being a colonized country, which was the case when immigrants started coming here. Hawaii was the place where a lot of the independence movement had its roots. Syngman Rhee, the first president of South Korea, spent time here in Hawaii. But I would say that in the last couple generations, South Korea has gone from being a developing nation, a war-torn nation, to one of the world's largest economies. And now in this moment, to being a global darling in terms of pop culture, right? We've got K-beauty, we've got K-pop, K-dramas. Everything Korean is super hot. And I've been amazed at how much the people of Hawaii are interested and love everything Korean. There's an opportunity there. There is an investment opportunity for South Korea to invest in Hawaii, and not only in sending tourists, but in exposing the global community that comes here to everything that they love about Korea. So I see a lot of opportunity, but there's a much more important thing, which is the shipbuilding, which we haven't had a chance to talk about. So when we go back to this issue of Indo-PACOM, President Trump does want to improve our naval capabilities. This is something that we are very interested in here, and that's to counter possible Chinese aggression. China is the largest shipbuilder in the world. South Korea is number two. This is what we're going to hear about quite a bit at this summit today.
And we're going to have you back and talk more about that as
well. Okay,
thank you. Thank you very much. Gene Lee of the East West Center, which Node East West Center is an HPR underwriter. If you have any questions about the impact of these global dynamics we've been talking about, impact on Hawaii, write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ulupono Initiative. By investing and partnering in local food production, Ulupono supports Hawaii's farmers and ranchers who help reduce the risk of wildfires through land management and stewardship.
America's boys are falling behind in school. We're launching a special series to find out why. Episode 1, How Do Boys Learn?
He told the teacher, "This is boring." And he said he wanted to go home.
He calls it Six Cruel Hours of Our Lives, you know, an acronym for school.
Don't miss the start of Falling Behind, the Miseducation of America's Boys. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Welcome back to The Conversation on 100% member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. On Maui, groups are continuing to work together to help fire survivors in the community. There is one group that's come together that is unique. HPR's Catherine Kulapaktil has been following this story, and she joins us with more. And Catherine, this is a long-term recovery group that's part of a national trend with a local application, really. Tell us more about that.
Good morning. Yes, it is. Absolutely. So they were formed in the wake of the wildfires, like many other support groups that we've seen. They rely heavily on partnerships with existing programs that have also been working in recovery in Lahaina, particularly. They have a number of different programs for fire survivors. They're involved in a lot of different efforts. They are the Ho'ola Ia Maui Akama Disaster Long-Term Recovery Group, and Rhonda Alexander Moncrest is executive director of the group, and she explains that the organization, like you said, is actually based on a national model for community disaster recovery.
We get guidance, and our structure for the Long-Term Recovery Group is modeled after the National VOAD. So National VOAD is Voluntary Organizations That Assist in Disaster. And so it's a nonprofit group of disaster-related organizations, and they have one committee that's called the Long-Term Recovery Group Committee. And so they have a Long-Term Recovery Group guidebook. You know, so this is what we use to stand up and set up our organization. In disasters of this size and complexity, it is common, and communities are encouraged to set up community coalition long-term recovery groups because all of the government entities eventually go away, and who's left to help the community with the rest of the recovery is the community groups. So by forming the coalition, we have the established partnerships, the established pilina, and for us, we're putting together like common systems that we can use to make it easier for the survivor as well as for the nonprofits that are involved.
That really is setting that up for the long term, Catherine.
Absolutely. So, you know, there are a number of different federal programs, state programs. One of them has to do with disaster case management. And that is kind of a person who walks alongside you as you recover from disasters. They help with connecting you to resources. They help with, you know, day-to-day life and kind of walking that journey with you, right? And so Ho'ola Long-Term Recovery Group has started their own disaster case management. So previously, the main option for disaster case management for fire survivors on Maui was funded through FEMA and continues through the state. And this offers, you know, a secondary option. Again, as Rhonda said, you know, after the government assistance, you know, goes away, you know, the need for these services doesn't just magically end. And so they're offering that long-term community-based, you know, support as a resource moving forward. Another thing that they do is they help fill funding gaps for families. So, you know, there's so many different assistance options out there for fire survivors. Not everyone qualifies for everything. And so a lot of times families are left with just huge needs that go unfulfilled. And so the Long-Term Recovery Group has formed this Resources Roundtable, they call it. Again, this is kind of a national model. And it's really fascinating. They bring funders to the table. And again, those case managers who are working individually with fire survivors will bring anonymously their clients' needs to the roundtable, and they meet regularly. Initially, it was once a week. Now, I think it's more like once a month. But they say, hey, my client, you know, needs this in order to, you know, rebuild their house or meet their daily living expenses or, you know, whatever the case may be. And funders will step up and say, oh, yeah, I can cover this, or, you know, maybe we can work together with another funder to cover these needs for these different families. And, you know, Rhonda says that all are welcome to the roundtable who bring, you know, she says money, materials, or manpower. So, you know, they can be funders, they can be volunteers, they can be expertise people who, you know, electricians or, you know, people who can help with different aspects of home rebuilding, whatever the case may be. Bringing these resources together and connecting them at a really grassroots level with the people in need, you know, fire survivors who have these gaps. Another thing that the Ho'ola Long-Term Recovery Group is working on is a volunteer rebuild program. So Mennonite Disaster Service is a national program of volunteers that they do this. They go to different states following disasters, and they help rebuild homes. It's a really amazing, you know, just, again, volunteer effort at no cost to fire survivors. And so they're working with the Maui Long-Term Recovery Group to come next month to Maui, and they will be helping to rebuild 5 homes. Again, free of charge to fire survivor families. And right now the Long-Term Recovery Group is working to prepare the volunteer living quarters. So they are transforming the former site of the Sacred Heart School, right in the heart of Lahaina, into the living quarters where the Mennonite volunteers will be staying as they're helping to rebuild. Alexander Moncrest talks about how the organization is, you know, engaging with these fire survivors and how it's going to work for the next round of Mennonite builds.
Everybody goes through different phases of their recovery, and we're finding that people that have been just exhausted from trying to navigate this path are now emerging saying, okay, I'm ready again. Let's try and work on this. And let's see if we can, you know, move the needle with our family's recovery plan. So we welcome them, you know, to apply, to engage, to allow us to walk alongside them, you know, to assist them with their needs. Currently, right now, we're looking for the next 10 families for volunteer-built homes. You know, so anyone who is a homeowner, where it's an owner-occupied home, they can apply through Hawaii Community Lending, which is our partner in our Rebuild Coalition. So using their intake form, they apply there. And what's critical is we need these families to have a sense of urgency with uploading the right documents. So all of these things that we need to verify and validate as far as their financial situation. Once we do that, then we can put them into buckets of support. So here's the families that qualify for Mennonite built homes. Mennonite Disaster Services will be on island starting in October of this year to build the first 5 homes for Lahaina families. And we're in the process of selecting the next 10. So our kahea to the community is, if you feel that your family needs support and assistance with reducing the gap that they may have with rebuilding their home, then go to our website and apply under the housing tab for this opportunity.
And Catherine, that's such a good point. Not one size fits all. Case management and in it for the long haul, community-based combination of very important factors going into that. Catherine, thanks so much for the story.
Thank you.
That's HPR's Maui Nui reporter Catherine Kluet-Pachtel. You can read her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
In Brazil, former President Jair Bolsonaro is under house arrest for plotting an alleged coup. In response, Washington has imposed tariffs on the country. Brazilians, though, they're not having it.
Até porque presidente de outro país não deveria.
This woman believes in Brazil's sovereignty and says the U.S. should not get involved. That story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Betel nut is a common sight around Southeast Asia and many parts of the Pacific. Chewing the nut with its distinctive sharp taste and red color is a practice that's spreading here in Hawaii. But there are growing concerns about the health impacts. HPR's Cassie Ordonia has been following that story and joins us with more. And Cassie, part of your story starts on Big Island.
Yeah, so I recently took a trip to the Big Island to meet with a Yappies farmer who has been known for growing betel nut and is actually very prevalent on the Big Island, which is what I found new to my reporting. On Oahu, there actually are betel nut sellers here, especially in mom-and-pop shops and Micronesia Mart, but some of those mom-and-pop shops, said they get it from the Big Island. So Jeremy Uwolo of Yappies descent, he's been selling betel nut for over 10 years, but he recently bought property about 40 minutes away from downtown Hilo and has been growing over 100 betel nut, which is also known as areca palms. But it is interesting. There's actually a growing number of betel nut farmers. When I talked to Jeremy, he said that there are about more than a dozen betel nut farmers of Yappies descent, Vietnamese descent, and even Filipino descent.
Interesting. There's that cultural overlay as well that you're reporting on.
Yeah, there is the cultural aspect. Like if you look at Palau and even Yap State, which is located in the Federated States of Micronesia, back in the day, before the introduction of tobacco products from the Spaniards, it was actually a privilege to chew betel nut. It was actually only reserved for the chiefs at the time, or like in Yap State, when there were actually warring islands in the atolls at the time, you would use betel nut kind of as like this bridging the gap sort of sense. But Jeremy actually talks about how betel nut is actually used in everyday life in Micronesia.
There are serious chewers, the chew betel nut. And part of that is once you chew betel nut, then you're mixing in with tobacco, it becomes a habit. It's like smoking a cigarette. And I was just talking to an older lady from our Yappies community, and it's like, yeah, it's the... If you're a betel nut chewer, it's the first thing you put in your mouth, and it's the last thing you put in your mouth when you wake up or when you go back to sleep in the evening. And it's just interwoven in every activity you do. You wake up, you chew the betel nut, and you work. You chew the betel nut before you work, and you take a break to chew a betel nut. Right after dinner, the first thing you want to put back in your mouth is a betel nut, and whether you have tobacco or not. And so I think with chewing, the betel nut has... become more of a, within the Micronesian community here and even back home, it's kind of widespread more than it used to be.
So it's kind of used as this economic driver for Jeremy Uwolo. It was kind of used as fast cash for him. So for example, if you're a farmer on the Big Island and you know how to cultivate betel nut, the tree itself can produce over 500 betel nut itself. This is like the individual quids or the seeds that they like to call it. And at his old property in Hilo, before he moved to his new property, he used to sell 10,000 betel nut individual every year.
Wow. That's, yeah, talk about a cash crop, right?
It definitely is a cash crop. If you look at Papua New Guinea, for example, there are some betel nut sellers and farmers they use to sell betel nut to get out of poverty. That's also something new that I found in my reporting. But here on the Big Island in Hawaii, if you sell betel nut, you can make $100 to $200 off one tree. And when I went to the small farmers market, most of the sellers there, they weren't growers, they were sellers. They were of Filipino descent. They don't chew, which was interesting. They have family members who chew, but the sellers themselves, they don't chew because they say it's bad for business, of course. But yeah, he's been Jeremy Uwolo, he's been selling for 10 years, and he actually quit chewing betel nut for 10 years. And he quit for two reasons. The first reason was because it's bad for business. He doesn't want to chew his own product or else he won't be making money. And then the second reason is he went to a trip to the dentist, and his dentist advised him, like, hey, these are the long-term effects. It's staining your teeth, and it could lead to oral cancers. And Jeremy decided to quit as a personal choice.
Yeah, those are pretty persuasive arguments. Just, I mean, the whole health aspect of this.
Yeah, and but there are some folks who are trying to quit chewing betel nut, but it has become addictive, especially when you add tobacco products. And when I talked to Neil Palafox, who's the professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, he's been studying betel nut with a group of researchers from UH and the University of Guam since 2003. And he says the health effects of chronically chewing betel nut, especially adding the tobacco products, can be an addictive element.
The chemicals in betel nut do several things, and why it's addictive, because it increases the heart rate, it makes you flush, it has a psychoactive substance in it, and it actually stimulates the area that's similar to nicotine in the brain that cigarettes do. And so it makes you have a little bit of a feeling of elation, and but it's short-lived. But I guess the point is, it does stimulate chemicals in the brain, chemicals that make the heart go faster, even some chemicals that help with digestion and relaxation. So clearly, there's those health effects. But I think when you talk about health effects, to outline that there's adverse health effects, which is what people are really talking about. And so the main one is that chronic betel nut chewing, the arecoline in betel nut, which is one of the main substances from chewing betel nut, is classified as a class 1 carcinogen, meaning that there's no doubt it causes cancer, but it's dose related. So it's not like you chew it once. It's not like it's similar to if you smoke a cigarette once, you're not going to get lung cancer. It's the chronic nature of the chewing, constant chewing, multiple betel nut time after time, that gives you a lot of the alkaloid, which then, you know, is a class 1 carcinogen, which means it causes cancer, and it can cause cancer of the mouth, of the esophagus. There's some folks that feel that, and then this is under study, that it also can cause adverse effects in the liver, but that's still not 100%. But certainly what it does is it changes the microbiome, the composition of bacteria in the mouth, and that affects how different chemicals and what you eat produce, and so it can be more deleterious just by changing the microbiome or the composition of the germs in your mouth. So it causes cancer, I guess, in summary.
Yeah, and that addictive nature actually starts from what Neil Palafox and other health experts have found. It starts at a young age. So two people who I've interviewed for my story, they started chewing betel nut as early to one of them actually said 5 years old, to be honest. Wow. But with the tobacco products, they started chewing as early as middle school to high school, and that's generally the norm. There are actually some restrictions in Micronesia to prohibit the import and sale of betel nut, especially to minors. In Hawaii, I found none, specifically to the sale of minors. There are restrictions in the state of the import of betel nut within Hawaii when it comes to propagation. That's according to the State Department of Agriculture and Biosecurity. And for the Department of Health, some of the spokespeople say that it is quite legal to chew betel nut in Hawaii, but there are restrictions to spitting in public, for example, or using tobacco products at state parks or county parks. But for betel nut, because it's sold separately from the tobacco products, it's kind of harder to regulate. And when I talked to Victoria Jade, she's 27 years old. She spends $200 a month just on betel nut products along with the tobacco, and she's still trying to quit till this day.
I've thought about quitting so many times. For one, here in Hawaii, it's so expensive. Like, you could get one bag for $7, and it's only like 5 pieces inside. If you make the math, it's like 170 some a piece of betel nut. That it doesn't make it. No, it's too. It's so expensive here, especially during dry season when everybody, all the stores are trying to limit their sale. Like people who come to buy betel nut, each person can only get one bag of betel nut. Like they do stuff like that. And so I've thought so many times about quitting. Strictly for the financial burden, you know, just like I should just stop buying betel nut because it's so much money. The cigarette is expensive. The betel nut is expensive. Everything about it is expensive. There's no benefit to it, in my opinion. But, and I've stopped from like, I would stop for a week. And then I'd end up going to the store and then I'd see betel nut on the shelf that's like, oh, this is good. This is good size. It looks fresh. And then I'd buy.
Really a layered story about the rise in betel nut chewing in Hawaii. Cassie Ordonia, culture and the arts, and sometimes betel nut. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Episode series Chief of War is streaming now on Apple TV Plus. It's based on true events beginning in the late 1700s. It tells the story of the warrior Kaiana, played by Jason Momoa. Also follows the rise of King Kamehameha as he moves to unify the islands. Two companies that track movie and TV streaming put Chief of War in the top 10 of streaming series. The company Just Watch put it at number 3 in its latest release. The review website Rotten Tomatoes aggregates reviews. That now has a 93% positive rating. And locally, of course, it is the buzz. Story itself, rich in history, told with some dramatic license. A groundbreaking project in a number of ways, including the work of Native Hawaiians and Polynesians on both sides of the camera, in the cast, on the production crew, starting, of course, with Jason Momoa. The phrase passion project is often used for this series. Here at Hawaii Public Radio, we're tracking the series episode by episode with a limited release podcast. It's called Feathers and Fire. We're joined by the host and writers, HPR Director of Programming and Content Development, Russell Subiono, and University of Hawaii Hawaiian Studies instructor, Mehana Maki'ina'i. And aloha.
Aloha.
Aloha, Bill.
Thanks for having us.
Mahalo to both of you for making some time for this. So I wanted to start with what may be an unfair question. There are so many aspects of this project that are groundbreaking. What is top of mind for each of you about why this is such an important series? And Russell, let's start with you.
To me, the obvious thing is the scale and scope of the production. This is something that we have not seen for Hawaiians in probably ever in cinema. Hmm. This idea of this large epic story told on such a large broadcast platform. And the involvement of Kanaka in front of the camera as well as behind the camera, even down to the background actors. This has been such a huge, monumental moment for people in the industry, Kanaka in the industry, as well as Kanaka broadly. We've never seen ourselves up on screen like this before. And to me, it's been a long time coming, and it's been epic to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll add on to it that majority of this series is filmed Mako'olelo Hawaii, in the Hawaiian language. And I think that this is a really incredible and proud moment for our language, for our speakers, for our Kaiapuni students, our students who are in immersion school, to see, wow, there's this entire series on this huge platform, like Russell said, that is now available in the host culture's language. And I think that that's important to make our language more mainstream, and Chief of War can help that to happen, to encourage additional people to learn, to be inspired, to look into it, to support different initiatives. So I really am excited by Chief of War and appreciative of their deliberate use of the Hawaiian language.
You know, you talk about that as well, and not just for students of the language itself, but more casually. I find myself sort of leaning into, you know, Hele Mai. Oh, wait, I know that one.
Good.
And then that reminds me, oh, Hele Aku, I should know that one too. And it brings more people who may not be, again, studying actively the language, but because the language is such part of the culture, just a reminder of that and a refresher, really.
Yeah, and really, if you live in Hawaii, you should know a little bit of the language, if not all of it, right? And the more we make it easy for people to hear and to possibly incorporate, like you said, hele mai, you know, panikapuka, shut the door, like little things like that, we can start to build towards more conversational dialect. And the more people we have speaking a language, the better.
There's also the part with history. And I know, Mehana, that's your alley on this. Folks who have maybe a casual passing with some aspects of Hawaiian history, but also Keomoku Street. And oh, that's what this comes to. There's a lot of backstory that comes through with this.
Yes, Chief of War uses real characters. Mm-hmm. So like you mentioned, Keomoku, Ka'ahumanu, Ka'iana, these are real people who are a big part of our traditions and our legacy here in Hawaii. But as Russell and I point out, and I think Chief of War has also pointed out many times, this series is not meant to be your history lesson.
Right.
Right? It's meant to introduce you to aspects of culture, to showcase some very important figures in our societies, and then to dramatize it and kind of have fun with it. And they change the story in quite a few areas. But the exposure also gives you that gateway to say, hey, what else do I want to learn? What do I want to know? Who am I going to look up? Where can I go? And that's very important.
And I got to tell you that the podcast itself is helpful in that way, as sort of bridging to learning more about this. Russell, I know you've been at this for a while in terms of structure and putting that together, but it flows nicely into that.
Oh, thanks for saying that. When I put together the podcast, and I want to give credit to Savannah Harriman Pote for coming up with the idea and then telling me, oh, you should do this. And I immediately ran with it. But in putting together the podcast, what I think would set it apart was the idea that we could provide additional context to what was being seen on screen. And we could explain some things and maybe educate some people on why Hawaiians do things a certain way, or why they dress a certain way, or why they use certain implements. But I also wanted it to be fun. And I wanted us to have a fun, engaging conversation where we could maybe poke a little bit of fun at some of the things that happened on the show, but also at each other. So I was very fortunate enough to come across Mehana, who was game for all of that, for educating people as well as to just have fun conversations. So it was like finding a diamond in the rough. And then it kind of just worked from day one, from like the first test episode that we did. I knew that we could have a lot of fun doing this.
And part of the fun that you do, you have some great guests, by the way, along the way.
Oh,
also,
thank you.
And there are little Easter eggs hidden in there as well as surprises. But one thing that I like, you have a category section. So we're going to do a little bit of a category section here for each of you, and relatively briefly. But what's the biggest surprise to you about the production itself so far?
For me, it's the production value, just like how much money they invested into creating a series that is on par with a lot of these other epic series that we've seen from HBO or from Apple. I'm thinking of things like Game of Thrones or Shogun. Mm. And they're not a one-to-one comparison, but the amount of production value and the amount of money that they spent to make this look really good and to especially make it sound really good, like the sound design of all the episodes are really good, really deep. And I was a little taken aback at how much they wanted to make this a really epic series on par with a lot of other things that we've seen. So that was probably my biggest shock, but also source of my biggest appreciation, because it, in one sense, it really says that Hawaii and the stories that we tell here are just as interesting, just as entertaining, and just as important as any other story that's out there.
Mehan?
I think my biggest surprise is that a lot of people, when they're looking at Chief of War, they're like, is it going to be accurate? Is it going to depict us in a good light? Are we going to be very kind of Hollywood in how all of this is portrayed? And I think my biggest surprise is, because I had those concerns too, is that Chief of War, I feel like, has done so many wonderful things for getting people interested in our stories and recognizing incredible feats and skills that our kupuna in Hawaii had. And so I think that it was very deliberate in how Jason Momoa and Pa'a Sibit and everyone came together to, yes, we want to tell a story that is going to sell and is going to be very dramatic and is going to have all this cinematography associated with it. But we also want to bring in really important and cool aspects of the culture and honor the Hawaiian culture. So I've had fun with not just picking it apart. Like, I think if you don't just come in there and want to pick it apart and say, well, that's not accurate and that didn't happen. If you don't come at it with that attitude, but instead you come at it with the attitude that, wow, like they're showcasing events that maybe didn't happen in the right order, but these are events and these are skills that our people had. How cool, how wonderful. So it's a good blend. And I think Russell and I, in our podcast, we kind of blend that too between the historic and then we get into the story and we're just talking about the story and from the storyline.
You got the history, you got the fun. Going to leave with a quick one-liner or so each. For someone who hasn't watched any of this yet, what's the biggest reason to give it a shot?
I think it showcases the beauty of Hawaii, the beauty of our people, how we are in spirit, how we appear, how we dress, how we interact. But also the cinematography is just excellent. We get some really incredible shots of, and I'm biased, but some really incredible shots of like the lava deserts in Kau, some shots of Waipio Valley on the Big Island. It was also shot on Kauai and Oahu, so we get a lot of really beautiful scenic views of those islands as well. And I just think that even though this show is titled Chief of War, they really did go a long way to incorporate a lot of beauty into the series. And if you're, I don't know, if you're interested in Hawaii at all, the beauty is there.
I'm going to go with it's entertaining.
Nice.
Like, if you want to watch something and have a good time on Friday night and just enjoy, I think that Chief of War has created a really compelling storyline and you'll have fun with it.
Yeah, there's a lot of intrigue and a lot of drama that we flesh out in the podcast, and we have a lot of fun with.
It's a good listen. Russell Subiono and Mehana Makainai, the hosts of Feathers and Fire. It's our newest podcast here at HPR, following along with Chief of War. New episodes in the podcast every Monday. Check it out today. New podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation.
Mahalo. Thanks, Bill.
That is the program for today. Tomorrow we plan to share some of your feedback about the renewal of military land leases in Hawaii. Want to add your thoughts? Call our talkback line. Leave a voicemail. The number is 808-792-8217. Or you can email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Bill Dorman in for Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.